Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, what was hailed as a bipartisan deal on immigration was announced in the Senate earlier this month. Media usually like that kind of political coming together, never mind the details. With Capitol Hill negotiations certain to continue, journalist Deepa Fernandez joins us to talk about the immigration conversation and what the press is missing. Also on the program, in a similar vein, congressional dealings on trade agreements have made headlines recently, with much talk over whether such deals should have to include labor and environmental side agreements. Some say if workers and the planet are side issues, maybe we need a whole new vision of trade. We'll hear from Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the International Relations Center. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
On May 16th, a majority of Democratic senators voted for Senator Russ Feingold's plan, which called for timetables and a phased withdrawal from Iraq. The bill was defeated, but ABC World News correspondent Jake Tapper suggested this was a sharp turn nonetheless for the Democrats. Quote, "What was considered radical just a few months ago on Capitol Hill is now mainstream Democratic thought." Close quote. Tapper quoted some senators who supported the bill, then described Democratic support for timetables as, quote, "a startling shift, once cautious Democrats now trying to outflank one another on the anti-war left." Close quote. To bolster the idea these senators are simply wrong about the Iraq War, Tapper turned to multimedia star and Iraq War advocate Fareed Zakaria, who said withdrawal would be a bad thing. Quote, "A rise in insurgent activity in Iraq, an increase in the bloodletting, an increase in the civil war." Close quote. Tapper then went on to quote Kurt Campbell of the Center for a New American Security, who said, well, more or less the same thing, adding a reference to, quote, "some sort of al-Qaeda strongholds inside the country," close quote. Well, there you have it. Withdrawal timetables would be bad, radical, incautious, and, of course, leftist. Well, at least in the elite media bubble where Tapper, Zakaria, and Campbell live. In the real world, majorities of Americans have been supporting timetables for some time. A May 9th Gallup poll found 60% in support. The majority of Americans are, apparently, radicals.
The Comey Ashcroft Hospital bedside story has drama, mystery, and national significance. It could be a major media story if, well, it got more media. For those who haven't heard, former Deputy Attorney General James Comey testified recently to a Senate hearing about extraordinary efforts by the Bush White House to get approval for an extension of the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance program. Comey had refused to sign on, he says, at least in part because the Justice Department thought it was illegal. Evidently, Comey and even Ashcroft were ready to resign if they were overruled by the White House. Sounds interesting, right? But it gets better. Their plan thwarted by Comey, who was acting attorney general while Ashcroft was hospitalized for gallbladder surgery, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card and then counsel Alberto Gonzalez actually went to Ashcroft's hospital bedside to try to get him to overrule his subordinate. In a scene that sounds like a movie script, Comey and FBI Director Robert Mueller confronted them at the hospital, and Ashcroft dramatically rebuffed Card and Gonzalez's efforts. No word what his doctors thought of all this. Later, unspecified changes were made to the wiretapping plan and the Justice Department approved, leaving, one would imagine, all sorts of important questions. Those questions just aren't very interesting to the press corps, though. Two of the three network evening newscasts passed the story up entirely. ABC gave it one sentence in a piece on Gonzalez's political future. In elite media, the Washington Post appears to be virtually alone in taking the story seriously. Their May 18th editorial argued that it, quote, "matters enormously whether the president was willing to have his White House aides try to strong-arm the gravely ill attorney general into overruling the Justice Department's legal views. It matters enormously whether the president, once that mission failed, was willing nonetheless to proceed with a program whose legality had been called into question by the Justice Department," close. Quote. The paper concluded, quote, "The president would like to make this unpleasant controversy disappear behind the national security curtain. That cannot be allowed to happen," close quote. The story could very easily disappear, though, if present media trends persist. In fact, what ought to be a scandal has not yet appeared in some of the nation's largest media outlets.
Israeli forces stepped up their attacks in the Gaza Strip last week, actions they claimed were in response to Hamas rocket attacks. Some prominent media coverage focused on Israel's restraint. On May 18th, the Wall Street Journal ran a piece headlined, "Crude Palestinian Weapon Creates Israeli Dilemma," which argued the use of Qassam rockets somehow prevented Israel from responding as forcefully as they might like. That was echoed in a May 23rd New York Times news analysis. The piece made two references to Israel's use of their most precise weapons. This came exactly 2 days after the Times reported that an attack on a Hamas politician's home killed 8 people, none of them the intended target. Nonetheless, the Times stressed that Israel was restrained in its behavior, pointing to the apparent need, quote, to keep on Washington's good side, close quote. Well, that's hard to square with the Bush administration's record of nearly uncritical support for Israeli military actions, not to mention the fact that the Israeli government has declared any Hamas politician a legitimate target, which sure doesn't sound very restrained. And Likud party leader Benjamin Netanyahu was quoted discussing, quote, controlled stoppage of services such as electricity and water, close quote, an outlook the Times described as speaking carefully about the options. The Times also argued that, quote, trying to calibrate the amount of military pressure that might persuade Hamas and the Palestinians to stop the rocket fire and recreate a working ceasefire over Gaza is not an easy calculation, close quote. This idea that a certain level of violence will lead your enemy to stop is usually considered permissible when you identify with the party who's waging that violence. It's pretty difficult to imagine a mainstream reporter would discuss, say, Hamas's attacks as part of their calculated effort to create peace.
The May 18th Nightline included a memorial profile of two Iraqi ABC journalists, cameraman Alauddin Aziz and soundman Saif Laith Yusuf, who were recently killed in Baghdad. Nightline anchor Cynthia McFadden began by noting that most of the Iraqi journalists killed in the war have been faceless and nameless. And reporter Terry McCarthy underscored the point in his introduction. Quote, you didn't know these men. You never heard their names until today. But they and many other Iraqi cameramen and soundmen like them are the only way American television can cover this war. Close quote. That's a pretty serious indictment of media neglect, if you think about it. Sadly, a segment that seemed to be about recognizing the significance of Iraqi lives was prefaced with the erasure of hundreds of thousands of those lives. Setting up the profile, McFadden stated, quote, as of tonight, the war has claimed the lives of 3,409 American soldiers and as many as 70,000 Iraqis, close quote. The difficulties of tallying Iraqi deaths have been noted, but 70,000 would be absurdly low by any serious account. And the phrase, as many as 70,000, suggesting the figure is the upper limit, is simply unjustifiable. Nightline may be relying, as other ABC news programs have done lately, on the tally from the group Iraq Body Count. But this is incomplete by the group's own admission, because it includes only those civilian deaths that are reported in English-language media. Iraqi combatants, those who resisted the invasion, and those who support the U.S.-backed government are excluded. And, of course, many deaths are never reported. A comprehensive epidemiological survey by Johns Hopkins University, published last year, described between 400,000 and 900,000 excess deaths by violence to Iraqis, civilians and combatants, since the U.S. invasion. If Nightline has reason to disbelieve the Johns Hopkins survey, they should present it. In the meantime, they must accept some blame for the namelessness they appear to be lamenting of the Iraqis killed by this war.
And finally, the press is campaigning to get another presidential candidate kicked off the national stage. Republican candidate Ron Paul captured media attention during the May 15th debate when he talked about the justifications al-Qaeda has offered for the September 11th attacks. Quote, they attack us because we've been over there, we've been bombing Iraq for 10 years, we've been in the Middle East. Close quote. Paul underlined his point by saying, have you ever read about the reasons they attacked us? Rudy Giuliani responded by saying he'd never heard that before, which got sustained applause from the audience. But what Paul said was in line with what al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden have been saying for years, something the 9/11 Commission, among many others, have noted. To say you're not familiar with this is just bizarre. And the press pounced. On Ron Paul. Time magazine's Joe Klein called it Paul's singular moment of weirdness and cheered that Giuliani, quote, reduced Paul to history, close quote. MSNBC's Chris Matthews said Paul, quote, has a big problem, close quote. Then he alluded to U.S. patrols over the no-fly zones in Iraq. But Paul never mentioned no-fly zones. He was talking about bombings in Iraq, which happened throughout the Clinton administration. CNN host Wolf Blitzer made the same no-fly zone comment when he interviewed Ron Paul and all but begged him to take back his remarks. Blitzer's CNN colleague Howard Kurtz slammed Paul's unorthodox theory and declared that, quote, news organizations are allowing ego-driven fringe candidates to muck up debates among those with an actual shot at the White House, close quote. Well, the real problem here isn't that Ron Paul can't win the nomination. It's that he said something the media didn't want to hear.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Talk of a bipartisan Senate compromise on a new immigration bill has pushed that issue into the media spotlight once again. Unless, of course, you're watching Lou Dobbs, where immigration is a near nightly obsession. Media are fond of anything that might be called a product of the two political parties coming together. The assumption is that a sensible middle ground has been reached. On the subject of immigration, though, that political middle ground has shifted well to the right in recent years. What role does the press play in this, and what immigration stories are they missing? Joining us now to talk about it is Deepa Fernandez. She's host of the morning radio show Wake Up Call on New York City's WBAI and author of the book Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration. Deepa, welcome to Counterspin.
Hey, Peter. Thanks so much for having me.
The discussion of this issue, as we said, has shifted well to the right. Lou Dobbs is the most obvious example. He's hardly alone. Bill O'Reilly supports this Senate bill, but he worries about the future of white America on the air. You point out in your book that what David Duke was talking about in the 1970s, a wall, military at the border, is now considered sort of middle of the road. It's one of the few issues where George W. Bush enjoys the reputation of being a moderate. How did we get here?
The question that I had was, okay, there's this really harsh immigration legislation that has passed over the past 10 years, in 1996 particularly, but then again it came up after 9/11. Where is this coming from? Who is writing this? Who's putting pen to paper? And when I looked at the 1996 legislation, which was very harsh and was really one of the first places where we saw a rush to detain and deport many non-citizens, where we saw a beefing up of the border. It wasn't 9/11 that started all of this. It started in 1996. And so as I was tracing that, I kept coming across these links to what groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center call hate groups, people who are out-and-out white supremacists, are connected to white supremacists, have been members of white supremacist groups. And their plank very openly is end immigration, period. Just stop immigration and let's get rid of many of the immigrants in the country, mass deportations or whatever that looks like. It was an overt strategy that particularly one man who was the head, he started an organization called FAIR, and let's just be really clear, it's not the wonderful Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Let's be clear.
It's the Federation of Americans for Immigration Reform. What John Tanton really wanted to do, and he put this in writing, it was explicit. He said in a series of memos to convince the American people of this agenda that I've just been talking about, we need to get to the hearts and minds of Americans and convince them that immigrants are criminals and convince them that immigrants are bad for society. Now, how do we do that? Well, it's got to be a multi-pronged strategy. It's got to be, we've got to infiltrate the judiciary. We've got to infiltrate the legislature. We've got to infiltrate grassroots organizing groups. We've got to infiltrate the environmental movement. I mean, it was all explicitly laid out. They were amazingly successful. And what's happened over the past two decades is you now are at a place where Democrats just as much as Republicans will be able to say, you have to be tough on immigration to get elected. Then 9/11 happens, and all of a sudden, it's like, that's the dream come true. It's not so much just that immigrants are criminals, it's now that immigrant equals terrorist. And we saw that explicitly in the fact that all governmental immigration functions are now subsumed by the Department of Homeland Security.
Now, as a journalist, you cover a lot of ground in the book about sort of related issues. You mentioned the Department of Homeland Security, I think a whole chapter about the kind of privatization of immigration enforcement via the Department of Homeland Security. But you also talked about covering a congressional debate over turning over enforcement powers to bail bondsmen. This is an amendment that didn't pass. Attending an immigration hearing for yourself to see this in person, going to Haiti to report on immigrants who'd been deported to jails there, guest worker programs in New Orleans. Why don't you tell us about that last issue?
Yeah, it was just shocking to me. And I have to look at our media that I myself didn't know anything about this. Why aren't we getting told the nuts and bolts of what a guest worker program is? We only ever hear a soundbite about a guest worker program. And what I found in New Orleans truly was shocking to me, because you have immigrants being brought in, mass advertising campaigns happening after Katrina in countries like Peru and Bolivia and the Dominican Republic and Brazil. Come and help rebuild the Gulf Coast. Come to New Orleans. And they were looking for skilled workers, mechanics, carpenters, civil engineers. And people paid a large amount of money to these recruiting firms. They then have to pass through a U.S. Embassy interview, and then they're brought to work for a company here. And the one that I was particularly looking at was the Decatur Hotel chain. And the Decatur Hotel chain is the largest hotel chain in New Orleans, in Louisiana. And they own, the Astor Crown Plaza on Canal Street. And Canal Street and the French Quarter, the tourist district of New Orleans, was rebuilt very quickly after Katrina. And so you had this need in the tourism industry for workers. Now, one might say, well, what about all the workers who lost their jobs? What about former residents? And there's still some 200,000 African Americans who have not been able to return to New Orleans, who are scattered around the country, around the state of Louisiana. And so the Decatur Hotel chain then turns to a recruiting firm. They bring in these foreign workers. And where it really gets crazy is that you sign a contract as a worker with Decatur. They say, we'll employ you for 40 hours a week. We'll pay you, say in one of the examples of the workers I was following, $6.69 an hour. It's just above minimum wage. But in return, the workers will sign off in this same contract that they will stay in housing provided by the employer. And these workers were paying the Decatur Hotel chain to stay in the most dingy Motel 6 room you could ever imagine. No windows. It's one of those ones where the bathroom is so small that the sink is actually outside in the main part of the room. They're paying $400 each a month, and there's four of them in the room. So Decatur is making $1,200 from these workers, four grown men in a tiny motel room. They also have to pay the employer for their transportation to and from the work site, and they have to pay the employer for food. Now, this is signed into a contract, so when I ask the workers, why don't you just leave for $1,200 a month? You can get an apartment in New Orleans. No, they can't, because they're bound by a contract. Mm-hmm. And then you have the hotel chain not honoring the 40 hours a week, so the workers are bringing in a couple hundred dollars every week because they're not being paid the amount of hours. So it's a really exploitative situation. And the kicker is that these workers, these guest workers, have no basic labor rights.
Well, given that guest worker programs are at the heart of this Senate debate, that's certainly food for thought. We've been speaking with Deepa Fernandez. She's host of the morning radio show Wake Up Call and author of the book Targeted: Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration, available now from Seven Stories Press. Deepa Fernandez, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter.
Global trade and trade agreements are complex issues everywhere, it seems, but in the U.S. corporate press. There, things are pretty simple. Trade is good, and really, if we're honest, only dumb people are losing their jobs. Or should we say, people who don't keep up their skill sets. And anyway, this particular course of global trade expansion is pretty much inevitable. Against that backdrop, it's a victory that so many U.S. citizens have developed critical views of trade policy and are even able to talk about alternatives. Keeping alive that critical conversation seems even more important. Now it appears that congressional Democrats may be willing to sign on to agreements without certain protections for workers or the environment, and to give the president fast-track authority to negotiate trade pacts with virtually no Democratic input. Here to talk with us about what people who don't write for the New York Times say are saying about free trade agreements is Laura Carlson. Laura Carlson is director of the Americas Program of the International Relations Center. She joins us now by phone from Mexico City. Welcome to Counterspin, Laura Carlson.
Thank you, Janine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, the U.S. media conversation about trade is one that's very closed to debate. Proponents of so-called free trade whenever and wherever, people like syndicated columnists Cokie and Steve Roberts, are comfortable making declarative statements like this from a May 20th piece of theirs. The figures are clear. Freer trade is good for American businesses, American workers, and American consumers. Later on, they say the fear-mongering about globalization is wrong. In fact, the opposite is true. Now, it isn't really so much a discussion as kind of a lecture. I wonder, are they looking at different data than those that are more critical, or how can we account for such widely divergent views on trade?
Well, it's really a shame that the trade debate has become so polarized because people tend to see what they want to see. Mm-hmm. Basically, what's happened with the data is that, in the first place, there isn't much data. This is one of the major reasons that we are now calling for a moratorium on free trade agreements. The General Accounting Office has produced very few reports as to what the real results of these agreements have been, and Congress itself has commissioned and produced very few reports as well. So we have a lot of anecdotal kind of information, but we really do not have a conclusion. What happens usually in this is that the people who are in favor of trade cite trade data as proof that the agreements are working. They say that, for example, in NAFTA, there's been an extreme increase in trade between the three nations. This is absolutely true, and this is to be expected. There's been an increase in both trade and investment. But what we're insisting is that in order to really evaluate them, you have to evaluate them on the basis of, are these agreements making citizens' lives better? And when you begin to bring into those social indicators and other things besides just the amount of trade that's going over borders, that's when you begin to see real problems.
Well, for some of us, it's often just strange to hear labor side agreements. First of all, remember the conversation about NAFTA, where labor and environmental concerns at one point were going to be central in these deals, you know, but to hear about people being a side issue is kind of upsetting in the first place. But then we so often hear about the labor agreements, particularly this time around, being the sticking points in arriving at deals. I wonder if you can clarify that a little. What is it that worker advocates are calling for that's not being offered?
Well, the side agreement that was put into NAFTA had serious problems because it's so subordinate to the trade regulations. And you basically have the two things working against each other. One is assuring mobility of capital and investment so that it can go where it can get the cheapest and most docile labor forces. That's working to erode labor rights in all countries. And the other is supposedly a commitment to labor rights. In this current debate, the supposedly bipartisan agreement, and I say supposedly because there were very few members of the Democratic Party that were even involved in this agreement or knew anything about it, and they still are far from having a consensus even amongst themselves. It includes supposedly enforceable labor rights based on ILO standards. But number one, the sanctions and the enforceability of those are highly suspect. And although we don't even really know the text of this agreement, so it's difficult to evaluate it in very specific terms, what labor is saying and what the people who have read the conclusions or the summary of it are saying is that they're completely insufficient to really protecting labor rights, both in the United States and in the other countries.
U.S. media consumers will have been primed to hear the idea of a moratorium on free trade agreements as bordering on lunacy, if perhaps well-intentioned. Newsweek's Fareed Zakaria wrote recently that while corporate globalization, he called it change itself, you know, change has caused real pain for real people, he said, we can't solve this by slowing down or shutting off trade. Now, does a moratorium mean shutting off trade?
This is the big lie about the arguments against the moratorium. The United States has been trading internationally, of course, throughout its entire history, and there's no question whatsoever that it will and should continue to trade with other countries. That's a fact of modern life. It's a beneficial fact in many circumstances, and that's not going to change. However, when we talk about a free trade agreement, we are talking about a very particular model of international trade. And in fact, if you look at these agreements, most of the rules and most of the many, many pages that are contained within the agreements don't even apply to trade. They apply to other issues concerning intellectual property protection, investment guarantees, a whole series of issues that create real privileges to major international traders and large transnational corporations while having a negative impact on smaller businesses and on workers and citizens and the environment in most countries in which they're adopted. So there's a whole series of agreements, in fact, including the Andean Preferences Act, that would be continuing and a whole realm of possibilities of how to organize and regulate international trade that do not by any means have to pass through free trade agreements.
So you don't see creating an alternative trade policy as a pie-in-the-sky idea. It really partly involves reframing how we talk about it and not shorthanding trade to mean these very specific policies we've got thus far.
Right, and I think it's the most realistic possible plan, because if you're making policy that affects people's lives as much as trade and investment policy does, you should know what you're dealing with. We need to have more facts about how these policies are affecting people. We need to look at other options. We can't be wedded to an ideological model that has proved its failure not only in the United States, but in other countries where, in fact, it's brought down whole governments. It's not fair. It's not fair to U.S. citizens and workers, and it's not fair to the other countries who feel that just in order to access the U.S. market, by far the largest in the world, they have to accept a series of conditions that are putting them in a straitjacket in terms of their own development.
I'd like to thank you very much. We've been speaking with Laura Carlson. She's director of the Americas Program of the International Relations Center. Thanks so much for being with us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.